podcast that was Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 17. I think it really is episode 17 this time, of If This Is A Podcast, Then What's Christmas? This is the first unusual episode in that we're not just going through the advertising career of a luminary. Instead, as a follow-up to my chat with Paul Burke, which was episode, I've no idea, 4, 5, I don't know. We didn't talk about his book writing, his novel writing, because I thought, as I say at the start of this episode, that there's actually probably enough material for he and I to have a chat about that, because we've both written books and had them published. So I thought for any of you out there who want to know about what that process is like, either the writing of it or the selling of it or what it's actually like having it published, I thought we'd do a separate chat about that. And we did, which was great because it meant I could have another hour in the company of the wonderful and very pleasant and enjoyable to talk to Mr. Paul Burke. And also we could really cover a subject that I think a lot of people, whether it's your book or it's your other creative projects, you may be an art director and you want to do some painting or God, that sounded really patronising. Maybe you're an art director and you've drawn some pictures and you're doing something with that. I don't know what art directors do. Any kind of outside sort of hobby or other source of creativity or income, perhaps. This is possibly the podcast for you. So rather than me preview the entire thing, I'll let you have a listen. Hi, Paul. Thanks very much.
Hello,
for...
Ben.
Hi. That's very chirpy of you for 6 in the morning or 6:30 now.
I'm getting like my dad. My dad used to get up really early, and I've become the same. You know, I'll be getting older. That doesn't bother me, getting up. It's staying up late now that's the thing, nodding off during John Craven's news round.
I think everything goes in reverse, because when you get older, instead of wanting to stay up, you want to go to bed early, and instead of wanting to stay in bed all day, you're actually okay with getting up a little bit.
No, absolutely fine. Very happy to get up.
Yeah, so this will be our second chat, and it's because we didn't mention your books in the last one, because I kind of thought there'd be enough material or conversation between you and I, who are both, we're both published authors, to discuss for anyone. There's a sort of cliche, isn't there, that copywriters always have a half-written novel somewhere in their desk. And
I think it used to be the case.
Well, whatever, maybe it's a screenplay now, yeah. I'm not really sure, but... I thought it'd be good for, we can both give our experiences in terms of maybe the writing, the finding the agent, and the what exactly it's like being published, and whether it's worth sort of doing it and continuing for anyone who is interested in that side of things. Because I think if I hadn't done it, I'd be interested in the perspective of anyone who had.
Yeah.
So maybe we could kick off with going, why did you bother writing a book in the first place?
I think the reason I wanted to write a book in the first place is I just always like to write, and I don't know how anyone wrote any books or wrote anything at all before the invention of laptops and computers. I don't think I could have even attempted it on a typewriter, because I'd have lost all the pages, and how people wrote them with a quill, I just don't know. So I always had this idea in my head, and it was at a time when, 10, 12 years ago, when having a laptop was still quite cool. And I was working at BNP, and I borrowed one to go on holiday. So I go on holiday with my wife, who, I don't know about you, I'm sure I speak for a lot of people. You're absolutely fine, you're very happily married, but you go on holiday, and your wife, or indeed yourself, you become concentrated versions of yourself, and you can't get away from each other. And my wife is always, she's actually better now than she was, but at the time she really was one of Britain's leading sunbathers. And I'm not, I've got that sort of beautiful sort of silvery white Irish skin. I don't really want to go out in the sun. And so we were on holiday. And she's sort of, again, one of those people, this is like therapy, who she's happy, she thinks everyone else should be. So she'd go, look, it's 33 degrees, boiling hot sunshine by the pool. What's the matter with you? And it's a bit like me saying, look, it's Arsenal, Man United, life on Sky. What's the matter with you? But if you don't like that sort of thing, don't like that sort of thing. So we had two small children. So we're on holiday with my wife, who is sunbathing, and my mother-in-law, and my wife's sister, and I had two kids by then. They're quite small. And when I wasn't sort of looking after the kids, I'd go into the shade with this laptop, because I always had this story not a story in my head, always a theory. I was little, I had the classic North London Irish Catholic upbringing, and I'd stand at Mass when I was a child in North London. And once I found out, what sex was and what a virgin was, and I thought, well, she hasn't done that sex thing, so the Virgin Mary couldn't possibly have a baby. And I've never known anyone walk on water or perform miracles. And, again, very young and very naive, thinking, but this can't be true. And if I think this and I'm nine, what does the priest think? So I always thought to myself, if you actually, made a priest speak the absolute truth, do you really believe that a man rose from the dead? Do you really believe that a woman gave birth to a baby having never had sex with the father? Priests aren't stupid. They can't believe it. So I just thought, what if there was a priest who was a really brilliant priest, but didn't believe in God, but kept that quiet. And so I got the story going, and I had a go at it on holiday when my wife was sunbathing and the children were having their nap, in a way I'd never had a go at it at home, because you just don't. And once I got back after a couple of weeks, I thought, it's quite good, I quite like this. So everyone I ever met, I said, I'm writing a book. And so that they would say to me a couple of weeks later, if I bumped into them in the street, how's the book going? and gradually I got it done. That was the only reason, not to see if I could do it, because I just liked to write and just thought, I'll have a go at it. It really was not as simple, because no one has ever written a book could ever claim it's simple, but it was as straightforward as that. It really was.
Cool. Well, I think that's an interesting way of you getting your kind of plot. And just to give you mine, only because it's quite different to that, and there are similarities. I mean, the novel that I had published is a sort of Michael Crichton-esque techno thriller, the kind of thing you find in an airport and in Indeed take on holiday to read. And I found that what made me write initially, because I did what I think a lot of people have done, which was set my first novel in the world of advertising, possibly to settle some scores or to get some therapy going or whatever. And I wrote it, and I sent the first 50 pages to some agents, and some of them were interested, and then the rest of it didn't really work out. So I started writing a very different book, which was the Michael Crichton techno thriller kind of thing. And I realized that actually the times I was more driven to write was when I wasn't as happy at work. Like if I thought there wasn't, it was almost like I had a subconscious need to find an escape hatch. So I would, if things, we hadn't sold an ad or I wasn't happy with, the way things were going, I would write more and write harder. But I did what you did, which is when I went on holiday with my wife, it was often to my wife's mother's house in France. We'd just be there for a couple of weeks before we had kids. I would go off for ages and go and write. And what happened with the novel is that I managed to get the first half of it done fairly quickly, not to a finished standard, but I knew what the plot was. And then I literally spent 2 years moaning to my wife that I couldn't work out what the second half of the book was going to consist of. And she would go, well, maybe it's this, maybe that. And it literally 2 years of not working that out. And then, weirdly enough, the situation that I don't know why gave me the impetus to absolutely drive it to the finish line in about 3 or 4 months was I went to a BBDO Creative Directors Conference in Miami, which you wouldn't necessarily think would be the most inspirational time. But it was very weird. So I did the CD thing and got very drunk. We all decided to vote for each other's work at Cannes or whatever was going on. And then I was due to get my flight back, and I just organized late checkout and sat in my room writing and writing and writing until it was time to get on the flight. And then I continued writing when I got home and didn't stop. And then that was it kind of done. So that may be a different reason why I wanted to do it, but that was the sort of process that...
It strikes me that a little like mine is that, this sounds so pretentious and self-regarding, but I think if you've published novels like we have, you are sort of allowed to say this, that if you are a creative person with stuff you want to say and things you want to, entertain or amuse people with, you've got to get them out. And in the world of advertising, for so many reasons, you can't always do that. So, yeah, I would get frustrated. I would get frustrated with the lack of writing, even with, by that time, I'd moved on to simply doing radio commercials. Well, actually, BNP always made me do telly as well, but there wasn't a lot of writing in it, and a lot of the radio sometimes, it was fairly prescribed. So I had 30 seconds about to say this, say that, say the other. So there wasn't actually, again, so conceited, there wasn't that much room for me in it. And a book was a great outlet. And I realised that I just used to like writing stories at school. My favourite ads, if I was still allowed to do them, if anyone did them, would be sort of Abbott-style long copy ads. So a book was almost like a substitute for the writing where we didn't get the opportunity to do in advertising, is how I feel. That's how it works. It's sort of the other way around. I mean, it's interesting what you say about your process. Mine was different. I had the beginning and I had the end. I knew where it was going. And again, because we were always told to cut this to 30 seconds, that's too long, can we trim that? I had, you know, a book and I knew it had to be about 70 or 75,000 words. And I'd do it and I'd be like, pretty happy with it. And I'd do a word count, 46,000. But I was in New York doing those Budweiser ads that we talked about before. And the New York cab drivers, the yellow cab drivers, were having a day on the Thursday where all their profits went to charity. And I thought, that's it. That's the bit I'm missing. So I nicked it. So I had the priest driving a taxi and giving all his funds to the parish. So he was a super good priest who just didn't believe in God. And once I had that, and once I had him driving the taxi, I could literally take him places around London. I could literally find things for him to do, and that gave me my extra. Well, gave me the bulk, gave me the stuff in the middle that got him to the cliche after cliche, got him to the end of his journey. But yeah, it's always something like that you need.
Yeah, it's also quite interesting because I was listening to Dawn French being interviewed on Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. It's the latest episode. And she was talking about writing her novels as well. And I think you sort of touched on this a little bit yourself. But, you know, you can write whatever you want. It's one of the few times when you're not in a collaborative creative situation where the director's going to say this and your creative director's going to say that and your client's going to say that. And if you're making a movie, the studio's going to say this and whatever, whatever. I think that writing a novel is the purest form of singular creativity you can really do, because it's all in your head and it's literally your head, a pencil or a paper or a keyboard, and you've written it down and that's it. And there's nothing else getting in the way until such time as an editor wants to, you know, have a chat with you or whatever. But it's just you and your creativity. And that's what Dawn French said. That's one of the things I appreciated, because in our day job, you get so much interference.
Oh, you do.
And then you can write whatever you like. It's kind of cool.
No. And also things like, and quite rightly, we have to have our ads approved by Clearcast and the radio, so that they're legal, decent. And just the thrill of writing the letters F-U-C-K. You know, not that my books are in any way sort of, you know, foul, but in real life, people say fuck. So in real life, the characters in my book said fuck. And it just felt really weird and really naughty to write something down that had those words in it and didn't have to be approved by anyone, you know. I have been, again, we touched on this before we actually started the interview. I love my partners, my former art directors. I'm in touch with pretty much all of them. You know, Facebook has made it very, Peter Gauss is one of them. He was over, saw him just before.
Great guy.
It makes it sound like I've never had a partner. But, I think not having a partner at all to do a book really did suit me, actually, yeah, because I like them as people. But yeah, I think this goes back to advertising. There are other people like me. I started on my own. I started in the dispatch department and I became a copywriter, if you like, by myself. I didn't go to art college. I wasn't paired with anyone. So I've always been a little bit singular because that's how I started. And other people who started in that way are the same. So being a writer was almost, being an author was almost like a natural progression. It wasn't hard for me not to have someone collaborate. In fact, it was a relief. Not that I don't like them, but as you say, it's all about you. And if you're happy to take all the credit, which I always am, and all the blame, which I am too, then it was fine. No, but it is, as anyone will tell you, as you know yourself, oh my God, it's lonely.
It is. And I've spoken to, or at least heard from Peter Suter in the past, because he was actually doing very well as a TV writer. And I think part of what got him to return to the world of advertising was the kind of loneliness and slight, not boredom, but I mean, I think if you've spent a few weeks or days or months, whatever, just on your own being the creative person, it's not the same as the whole banter in the corridor thing at your ad agency and, you know, making jokes with the person in the production department who's your friend and, hey, there's 15 people to go to lunch with. Who shall I go to lunch with today? So, yeah, I think that aspect of it does get a bit trying for some people.
I mean, I was still, I didn't leave my job. It was just a hobby for me. Yeah. You know, some people go fishing or, you know, some people build matchstick models of Canterbury Cathedral. And I was just building up this, I wouldn't say little book, but I would just write it. And as it got good, as I began to think it was good, then I got into it. And then managed to complete it. But it never leaves you alone. You know, you go for a little walk.
Yeah.
It's almost like the way that people describe depression, the black cloud on your shoulder. It never leaves you alone. At least with a script, a TV script, even a TV campaign, you've got to write 4 or 5 30-second commercials. It doesn't really take that long. It takes no time at all compared with writing a novel. And so it just never leaves you alone. Oh, my God. But I don't know, with the first one, when I did the first one, it was a hobby. It was my idea to write a book, and that was fine. Once I was under contract to a publisher, it was their idea for me to write a book, and it became a job, and that's why I didn't really like it very much.
That's interesting. You know,
be careful what you wish for. You know, I became a published author. That became my job. But, oh, my, yeah. Going back to what happened with it, I did it, and my ex-girlfriend that I used to live with, her sister was Georgina Cable, quite an eminent agent. And now I think about it, she was in her 30s and done extremely well. And when I first started going out with this girl, her sister, Rosie, they would just go, oh, so what are you reading? And they're going this book and that book. And I'd heard of them, the books they were talking about. But to them, they were brought up with books, and you were reading something. It's almost like saying, what are you wearing? What's that shirt you've got on? What's that jacket? Book are you reading? And they assumed, well, you're a writer, aren't you? You write those adverts. What are you reading? Have you read that? And I haven't read anything. And so I became more of a reader once I went out with her. And I saw Georgina in the street. I said, I'm writing a book, you know. And she goes, oh, send it to me, darling, when you've done it. And she later revealed that she was just patronising me, just sent it to me, and then I can put it on the slush pile. And she said she was dreading it in case it was shit. And again, the other thing with writing is someone could tell you you've got a Pulitzer Prize-winning work of genius or a piece of shit, and you'll go, you're absolutely right. You have no idea. You've got a rough idea, but you could be persuaded either way. And so I sent it to her, and I was on a shoot, and mobile rings. Oh, darling, it's marvellous. And I couldn't believe it. I wanted to cry because she was the only other person who'd really seen it. I mean, my wife knew what it was about, but, you know, didn't really read it. And then a little bit later, she said, I'll send it out to a few people. And it really was this simple. She goes, darling, I've got you a 2-book deal. I remember going, no, seriously, 2? I don't know any more things. What? I wanted to write one to show off, and I wrote a book. And she sort of couldn't believe it. I said, 2? And she goes, oh, this is great. You know, there's not many people, you know, get a 2-book deal. This is really, really good. It means they're serious about you, all of which was true. But I was horrified. I didn't know what to write about. It was the worst thing.
In terms of what to write about, can I just ask, going backwards a little bit in the process?
Yeah.
Did you read anything about book structure and what it ought to do, and anything about the background of writing, or did you just jump straight in?
Literally nothing. This is why I was always the worst person to go and talk to creative writing schools, because I managed to piss them off every single time by being seriously, simultaneously too cocky and too modest. I'd go, oh, I just did it, which was true. But it is, I didn't read anything. And again, it sounds like I didn't read anything about how to write an ad. I didn't go to you know, and on an advertising course. I wouldn't, you know, hesitate to say, oh, well, I'm just a natural talent, but I'd seen enough of them to work out how they might be done, and I just kept writing. I mean, just kept writing the book. My problem was, according to the editor, which is a nice problem to have, is it was mine were too short. Well, that's a good scene. Can't we stay in that a bit more? You know, in and out. But then that's advertising. You know, we have everything cut. But no, doing the second one, I knew with the second one, I sort of knew what you had to do, only because I'd done the first one. I'd been there before. And she takes me to lunch at the Groucho, obviously. And I said to her, in all seriousness, I was born in London and I still live there. Like about five, I'm sitting here now about 3 or 4 miles from where I was born. When I was 18, 3 days after I left school, I went to work in advertising, and I still do. I'm not saying I'm boring or dull, though I probably am. I've got nothing, I haven't got anything to say. I haven't got some fascinating life story. So she said to me, well, how about your school? I said, I just went to school in London, you know. And then I told her about I don't mean the serious, the almost comic brutality of the priests that used to knock us about. And then I told her how I worked in a cinema and how we used to tear half the ticket and to take the untorn ticket back to the box office to resell, and the things that used to go on. And she goes, hello, that's more life experience than most people have had. And how the manager was a drunk. He used to take us to these blues joints in Notting Hill, when Notting Hill was not the gentrified honeypot that Richard Curtis turned it into. And then I realised, and that was sort of quite, if you like, empowering. Oh, somebody's actually interested in my dreary life. So again, as you know from writing a book, you can take what's true, just change a few names, take the basis of truth and just build upon it. And so for the second book, I did that. That took me a lot longer because, as I was saying, it wasn't my idea to be writing the second book. They decided I was writing a second book, so I was under contract. But I think once you've done two, you can do more than two. Once you know it wasn't a one-off, once you know you can repeat the trick, you can do it again. And so I did.
That's interesting. I was going to tell you my agent story because there are huge differences and a couple of odd similarities. What I did, so I wrote my novel, and then I looked in the Writers and Artists Yearbook, which it contains the list of all the agents in England, and then you look at the ones who are like, they're agents for famous people or they're agents for very successful authors or authors you've heard of, and you start with them. This is in my experience. You start with them and then you get rejected by all of them. So you look down and say, who's not quite exactly who I had in mind, but I'll have a go with them as well. Go through them. If you're like me, you get rejected by all of them. And then you keep going to find less and less appropriate people. And I had been rejected by somewhere between 25 and 30 agents. But I finally found an agent, a guy called Robert, who was actually a non-fiction agent who represented books about the history of Google and things like that. And I was just like, fuck it. I'm just going to send it to him. So I sent it to him, and lo and behold, he sent me a note back saying, I really like the sound of your book, and having read it and whatever. So what do you how about I represent it? And I had a sort of half bit of interest from another agent as well, and I kind of played that up a bit more than was actually the case, which I wrote in the acknowledgements of my book when it was published. And then Robert took me to the Groucho Club. Apparently what you've got to do is go to the Groucho Club with your agent. And I didn't sign anything. We just kind of shook hands on it. And I was like, whoa, I don't know. Because I kind of thought, like, if he's been selling nonfiction books to nonfiction publishing houses, then does he really have any experience in doing this? How will he be when he goes to HarperCollins and Penguin and, you know, whoever else it is? But fuck it, it's the only show in town. So I didn't really think much of it. And I remember at this point, Daryl and I were kind of squatting in Dave Dyer's ad agency on Newburgh Street, just off Carnaby Street, and kind of just...
Exactly. So many. Which one was this? CDD?
This was Dye Holloway Murray.
And
he gave us a desk there, and that was great, really kind of him. And I just remember taking a phone call from Robert, the agent, a few weeks... In my memory, it's a few weeks later. And he said, so Penguin are interested. They'd very much like to publish your book. And I was like, what the fuck? What, Penguin? The things with the penguins? And
And he was like,
he said, Penguin, we should meet up with Alex, who's going to be your editor, and get on with it. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm going to have a... Well, I mean, there was a huge, as we'll talk about in a second, a massive gap between that moment and it actually getting published. But I was sort of on the way with the last chance, sort of lame three-legged horse in the paddock. And
got you into Penguin.
Yeah, and it's kind of to say to anyone who... you don't get Peter Fraser and Dunlop. Who are they representing you, Paul?
Yeah, I had them as well, so afterwards, yeah.
There you go. They're one of the top agents out there. So, you know, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And we'll get into the story of my non-existent second book later on, which was a much more kind of positive agent story. But, yeah, go for all of them and just keep trying until one bites. Maybe no one will bite, but number 30, a totally inappropriate agent got me sold straight away at Penguin. So there you go.
I mean, it's that story that people always hear in Malcolm Gladwell books and things like that. It's persistence.
Yeah.
Obviously, I suppose it even applies to sport, but it's persistent. We've known people in our industry who, and this isn't denigrating them as human beings, who weren't the most or aren't the most creatively talented, but persistent. They've gone for the jobs as ECDs. And I think it's the same. It's the same in writing. It's the same in any endeavour. That, you know, if you keep at it, sooner or later, someone will say, you know, say you wanted to find a girlfriend and everyone kept telling you to fuck off. Sooner or later, someone will accept you. No, that's always what I used to tell creative teams that this comes in with their work, who were good. I just used to liken it to looking for a parking space in Soho. Sooner or later, there's nothing there. You go round and round and round. Sooner or later, you just roll up. As somebody's leaving that parking meter, and you go, it's all about timing. Yeah, I, a bit like advertising, it does sound like, as I'm going through this story again, I've been incredibly fortunate at just turning up and it's sort of getting published and getting a two book deal. But I think your problems actually start when you do get published. It is a wonderful feeling. There's nothing quite like. For me, right, the birth of my kids, but being in Dawn's in Marylebone High Street and seeing my book on the table, it's a lovely feeling. And then when it was in the charts, the first one, I remember going to the kids. We were in WH Smith in Brent Cross, and I think I was number 17 and got the kids to move it up to about number 3. Then when the shop assistants were on, I told them off. What are you doing with those books? How dare you? But Dad, shut up! there's so many lovely things to do. But I'm sure you've got what I got is people in our industry saying, "Oh, I'm going to write a book." Oh, fucking are you? And the subtext was, they really meant it. I thought I had to be quite clever, but I see you've done one, so you clearly don't. and as I've said before, I love Navar, you and Meg Rosoff, who were the two people that talked to me about it, who actually went and did it and got published, you know, so many of them don't, you know. And we'll never know how many of our colleagues and friends have actually had half-written, three-quarter-written novels or fully-written novels that they managed never to get away, because you're not going to tell anyone. Although I did, I told everyone. It sort of didn't occur to me that I wouldn't get published. Again, not in a cocky way, but I think, again, brought up with advertising, that, not every piece of work you ever do gets through, but you're given a brief, and they want it on the air in May, and so, you know, there's a fairly good chance that your ad, that thing you've written, will run. And in my head, I'm thinking, there's a fairly good chance this thing I'm writing will run. I didn't realise... how heavily the odds are stacked against that happening. But then, isn't that always the best way? You know, ignorance, certainly in my case, ignorance is very often bliss. And so I got it, yeah, I got the first two out there.
Well, my thinking I don't know if it was cocky, it was kind of like that, and I'm trying to write a TV series at the moment, again, in my sort of spare time, but the odds are astronomically against that kind of any success happening. But I just kind of thought, well, the only way a book gets published is you write it in the first place, and then you try and get an agent, and then you get published. Like, all I can do is do those things and try and make it happen. And lo and behold, it did. But I mean, I knew that English was my best subject at school and all this kind of stuff. And I knew I kind of could write. One thing I got from other people in advertising, I think they thought I was going to write a higher brow book than I did, which is simultaneously a compliment and an insult, because yes. It's kind of like, where's your sort of literary kind of Booker Prize-y kind of thing? Why, we thought you were going to write one of those. Oh, you've written a kind of thick person's holiday novel or something like that. But maybe I'm reading too much into it. The other thing I was just going to say in terms of the publishing stage, which we're kind of at in terms of the story, was I went and met my editor, Alex, at what seemed to be Penguin's kind of club just off the Strand. And we had a chat, and he said, you know, he said not in a discouraging way about the quality of the book. He said, don't give up your day job. And we might get into this in just a second. But what happened was, so he said, the book's fine, but it's 80,000 words. We need it to be 100,000. And I said, but everything I've read on writing novels says trim, 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 make it shorter and shorter and shorter and cut out every third word and all this kind of stuff. And he leaned forward conspiratorially and said, that's literary fiction. So there's a difference between literary fiction and commercial fiction. And I
still don't know what that is. Well, I still don't know where the line is drawn.
I don't think anyone knows. And I think there's a midpoint, which is like Nick Hornby novels, where you're sort of middle brow and they're not literary so much as they've got a plot, I think, commercial fiction. But anyway, so what I had to then do was go away and add 20,000 more words into my novel. And, you know, I was thinking, am I adding new scenes? Am I beefing up the current scenes? Am I just, you know, finding other ways to describe stuff? And it was all of the above. I was actually in Vienna when I was freelancing at Lowe, and we were working on Noor by day, and then I go to my hotel room at night and add, say, 800 words or 1,200 words or whatever into new scenes and elongating current scenes and things like that. So that happened. The other thing he told me to do, which if anyone listening is going to write any kind of Michael Crichton thing, is you have to get the technical things right. You have to get the guns right. You have to get the helicopters right. You have to get the airplanes right in terms of what they can carry, what they can fire, and what they can kill. And he said, you've got to go and do that properly. And when you're saying about typewriters initially, I don't know how anyone could possibly do that research before Wikipedia. Wikipedia has a million pages on every single gun, helicopter, vehicle out there, and is incredibly useful and quick. But what I was going to do is get...
And also advertising sort of trains you for that, because we can't put out anything that's not true. So we're used to getting stuff absolutely right. Yeah, I was quite forensic about it, only because I remember reading a book, something about this bloke's obsession with pop music, and he goes, I always wanted to be Mark Bolan, and I stood with the tennis racket in front of the mirror, gyrating to Get It On was number one. It was 1972. I thought it was 1971. I don't believe a word. It's simple things like get it right. You know, if you go into my any of my books, seriously, and I say if you turn first left, it's Church Avenue, it will be. You know, I think cause whenever you read something, it's quite right. And especially nowadays with Wikipedia and all the tools we have are disposable, it's not difficult to check it and make sure it's correct. And yeah, I think you have to do that because otherwise everything else falls down. His name was who wrote that book, and it was great, but I just couldn't get over his getting the year wrong. I did have one thing.
Yeah,
is I've got a mate who's a cab driver, and of course, Father Frank, my first book, because he drove a taxi, was very popular among taxi drivers. And he goes, "Yeah, I liked your book," and I said, except for one bit. And I said, what? He goes, where the priest's sitting in his cab on the south side of Westminster Bridge? I said, what's wrong with that? He goes, it'd be in the fucking river. That's the bit of the river where it goes east to west, you know. Again, because you always think, yeah, got that wrong. But yeah, that was all.
Well, I had someone who reviewed it on Amazon who, if anyone doesn't know and would like to find out, you're very welcome to buy it. But my book involves giant wasps that can basically reduce a corpse to a skeleton very quickly. And his problem was that wasps that size would be the size of, say, doves or whatever, would have stomachs the size of postage stamps and would not be able to reduce a corpse to a skeleton that quickly. And I was sitting there thinking, this is my fantasy fucking brick-sized genetically engineered wasp. How the fuck do you know what it's able to do? But then I guess he was looking technically at the stomach size of a comparably sized flying insect or bird or whatever the hell it was, and taking me up on that and probably enjoying the fact that he was right and I was wrong about the size of the stomachs of brick-sized wasps and God knows what else. But yeah, there'll always be somebody who...
Well, you always quote that thing famously that the bumblebee is technically too heavy to fly.
Yeah.
The laws of physics, it should not be able to get off the ground. So, yeah, shut up and fuck off. I did love the fan mail. Oh, my God, because you don't get that with ads. Because we live in our own little bubble where we think David Abbott or John Webster or whoever or Hegarty is God. And I'm sorry to tell these people, most people have never heard of you. Most people have no idea. But Hegarty's got quite a high profile, and Trevor as well. But most people in advertising, people who are genuinely brilliant, people who really respect, you know, hello, Dave Dye, hello, Mark Redding. No one's ever heard of you. And I remember waving my book under Webster's nose. I said, you and your famous ads. I'm more famous than you'll ever be. He took it in good spirit. But, no, you do get fan mail, especially with my second one, which was principally about my school. And I just changed the name, but it was obvious which school it was. And I got quite a few from people who'd have probably been there earlier than me when it was even stricter, sort of in the 1960s. And a lot of them, their general gist was they were able to show the book to their wives and go, see, now do you believe me? You know, so I used to get quite a few of those. And I remember getting one from a woman. It came through the publishers, a lovely handwritten letter from a woman who lived about half a mile away in Muswell Hill. And I wanted to go round there and go, thank you so much. Or do you want to discuss how brilliant my book is again to my face? It's so pathetic, so needy, but, you know, creative people don't do part of it. Yeah, we live for praise, don't we? We live for praise. I certainly do. And it's lovely to get it. And quite upsetting when you look on Amazon, because there's always going to be a couple that think you're shit and try this and that. And it really is quite, they've no idea. Or they must have some idea. But unless they've, how hard you work to do that. And of course they're entitled to their opinion, and I've been equally scathing about other pieces of work, whether it's a film or a book or whatever. But oh my God, that person put so much work into it, you know. Shut up, don't be so horrible. But yeah, I did love the fan mail. I'm trying to think. Then I got another 2-book deal, because they'd done quite well, and then I had gone insane by the end of it. I couldn't do any more.
You know, can we just talk about the, in terms of the deal, I'll talk about my side of it in a minute, but do you want to talk about actual numbers or not?
No, I can't remember. I remember it was a very handsome advance, which is great. I got a lot of money. I can't remember exactly how much it was, thousands. But that's all great, but you don't get a single penny in royalties until that advance has been recouped by the publishers. So you could actually, depending on how many it sells, you could actually be better off certainly if it sells a lot, you're better off with a small advance and a few pence for every book that's sold. I did okay out of it, but it isn't enough to live on. And there's that statistic that I think I'm making it up, but it is something like 97 or 98% of published authors there on the tray, on the table or in Waterstones, all do something else for a living. And everyone reads about J.K. Rowling and people that make a fortune. But they, again, like footballers, the vast majority of footballers, you know, play for clubs like Rochdale and Tranmere Rovers, or even less than that, and have to do something else, or just don't get paid that much. And actors are an even better example. Yeah. They're very good actors, but they will have to do something else, otherwise they're going to starve. And the same is true of writers. And luckily, we had, both of us, we did have something else we could do. Thank God.
Yeah, I don't know what actually, I mean, the statistic I had was something like 250 people in Britain survive as exclusively as authors, which is a pretty crazy statistic. But I could actually tell anyone the amount, partly because it's interesting how advances happen. So I was given a £20,000 advance for my novel, which apparently was very high at the time. I don't know. I think things were a bit depressed in terms of how much advances we're getting and all this kind of stuff. So they were saying that's really good. What that breaks down to is, I think it's something like 5,000 on signing, 5,000 on delivery of the first manuscript, 5,000 on the final version of the manuscript, and 5,000 when it actually hits the bookshelves. Just to let anyone know, the process of how long it kind of took, thankfully as a hobby rather than my actual job, you know, that was pretty much working out at about, I don't know, $3,000 or $4,000 a year, and then take the tax off, take the my agent's cut off. And I think, you know, I'd be making maybe $1,000, $1,500 a year to write a very, you know, a relatively well-paid novel in terms of, you know, other advances were. So I got a good, healthy, pretty big advance for what I got from a major publisher to write a commercial novel, and it was an absolute pittance. And like I said, you don't just get £20,000 in your pocket the next day. You get $5,000 minus, you know, the tax and all the other stuff that you've got to kind of give away to other people. And then, you know, you make your money. And I never made my advance back, even though I sold 25,000 copies, because I think my royalty was something like 63 pence a copy. And I was also in Smith's, like you were, which was kind of fun, because I was Book of the Week. And if you're Book of the Week, your publisher pays for you to be Book of the Week. You're not like W.H. Smith has read every single book coming out that week and gone, this is our favorite. We've read them all and this is our favorite. That's not it. Basically, Penguin bung them a few grand to make you Book of the Week. And, you know, I was on all these shelves in whichever W.H. Smith it happened to be. But, you know, and that was immensely satisfying, to see your book for sale. Second only in terms of satisfaction to the book arriving in my home in a big box, like at the end of Back to the Future.
Yeah.
And you get to open it and go, oh my God, there's my name on the side of a book.
Yeah.
And I think when people wonder what you get out of writing a book, a lot of it is a personal sense of self-satisfaction, because if it's not going to make you the money to be, you know, self-sufficient, then I think a lot of it is about, you know, I wrote a book. I managed to actually write a story that's a coherent use of 100,000 words. And, you know, it's out there. And like we were talking about people having half-finished or three-quarter finished novels, it's good to have just finished it and done it, I suppose.
Yeah, it's that thing. It's pretentious, but it's true. That people say, do you like writing? I don't really, but I do love having written. I love having written. And that satisfaction once it's done. But oh my God, I did miss, I mean, jumping straight into something, my God, did I miss the advertising industry. For anyone who's listening as well, just so you know, the publishing industry, no wonder they're in trouble, in my experience. they were nice people, they were the most useless, inefficient, whatever you say about advertising, and there's a lot of criticisms, it's quite slick, we're used to getting things done, email that, bang, get it, urgent, we need that by 4 o'clock, and that's the way we were brought up, and in publishing, they're just, I'm generalising, but sort of dippy, lazy is the word I'm looking for. You know, they all worked sort of very 9 to 5. They were quite sort of airy fairy. And anyone who knows me, I'm the least sort of sharkish commercial person. But my God, you need a publisher to be run like an advertising agency with some account men and some people just doing it all properly. And the first person who does that, well, maybe it's too late, I don't know, would make a fortune. And it's full of frustrated writers, from my own point of view, because I'm not that well-educated. I didn't go to university. I haven't got a great love for Shakespeare and English literature. They can be slightly resentful but that you're being published and they're not. They don't mind if you're a footballer or you're some villain doing your memoirs. That's fine. They couldn't have done that anyway. But you, every now and again, you come across somebody in the publishing industry who you knew felt a bit like that. Not always. Some of them were delightful. And my editor, my first editor, Philippa Pride, who actually, unfortunately, just gave it up, was great. Yeah, and taught me an awful lot about writing and about how you show rather than tell, and this, you know, all those sorts of things that really helped me and really improved the book no end. So there are some great people, but oh my God, there was some. Oh.
Yeah.
The other thing about it, which people don't want to hear, but it's true, it is the most sexist industry I've ever come across. I mean, when you said Alex, I assumed that Alex was a woman.
No, Alex was Blake.
And that's quite unusual because the sexism, oh my God, every editor is a woman, every publisher is a woman, my agent was a woman. And again, in my experience, they weren't they weren't militant, sort of aggressive, man-hating feminists, but it was all just, it was just a very female environment. And I now can experience, can empathise fully with women who go and work in creative departments who find it all a bit male, all the lads playing table football and all that.
Yeah.
Because walking into a publishing house, it's the exact opposite. You're not disliked. I wouldn't say that for a moment. They're not anti-men. It's just a very, very female. 80-90% of the employees are female. They sort of patronise men in a way. I'm making this up a bit, but men just read Jeremy Clarkson and those SAS books. They don't read, do they? We've got to think of the female market. And so it's self-perpetuating. You know, if you carry on just catering for the female market, or for the male, for any market, they will be the ones that buy it, and that's what's going to happen. And, oh my God, on my second book, Untorn Tickets, which the cover is bright red, I had to really battle them. They wanted it pink. They wanted this shocking pink colour. And it is the least, if anything, it's a bit of a laddie book. It's about two lads, you know, who are growing up and working in a cinema, you know, based on no one in particular, who goes to this brutal school. So it wasn't, far from it, it wasn't a book that women wouldn't enjoy, and women have enjoyed it. But it was, you know, the target audience were male as well, very much so. They wanted it pink, and I had to really battle to make it red, because at least red is the colour of Arsenal and Liverpool and Man United, but yeah, there's an awful lot of that. So again, I think it's now George Eliot in reverse. If I was going to get published again, I'd try and make publish under a woman's name. If you're listening, women, girls, you're at a great advantage if you want to go and write a novel. Trust me, unless things have become a little more enlightened and the world has changed, it was very much skewed towards women.
Well,
yeah.
I think part of what actually helped me sell mine was that there was nothing, because Michael Crichton had actually passed away quite recently before I got my novel out there. And there was a huge gap in the market for male kind of fiction. I guess now you have Lee Child, and maybe Clive Cussler's still going, and maybe some of James Patterson's stuff does that. But a lot of it was very female chick lit and shopping and things like that at that time. And I don't pay enough attention to know what it's like now. But I 100% agree with you about the slow-moving business that is publishing. And what I found most annoying was if my editor asked me to do something, I would get back to them with the thing done, you know, within a few days or whatever. And I'd get no reply. And then I'd send another email going, Alex, did you get my email with that thing you asked me to do the other day? Still no reply. So 2 weeks later, I'd go, Alex, do you still need me to do that thing? Because I think I've sent it to you. And he's like, oh, yeah, great. Thanks very much. And compared to the advertising industry, you're going, you've asked me to do something. I've done it. I mean, I'd have thought the very least I'd get back is, oh, thanks. Yeah, no problem. You don't have to keep chasing them up email after email. But yeah, I guess it's a whole different kind of business that I'm not so aware of. But one aspect of that might be interesting is, in terms of writing, I wrote a second novel and some other stuff as well. And I often had conversations with Mark Denton about, you know, doing some ads for it or selling it or what it was going to look like and things like that. And I don't know, you know, your story about it, the cover being possibly being pink rather than red. They designed a great cover for me. And what's interesting, though, was the title, which initially I had as Insecticide, which I don't think is a very good title now, but they turned around and said, we should call it Instinct. And I was like, why? What's instinctive about the book at all? There's nothing about it being instinct. He said, it doesn't really matter, because once they've read a bunch of it, they're not going to think, oh, they fooled me into thinking it was about instinct. Instinct's just a good title. It's nice and abstract, and it's got some sort of punch to it. And so I had this interesting thing where I was going, do I believe the publisher, or do I stand my ground and go, hang on, it should be a bit of a descriptive title? So you kind of go, this is your industry, so maybe you know it better than I do, but I work in advertising, do I know it better than you do? I think there was a bit of that going on.
You do know better than them. That was what I was going to come to, is obviously your book needs to be publicised and they have a publicity department. And again, you think, oh, they must know what they're doing. But then you or me, we are their worst nightmare, because we've worked in advertising, and I wouldn't say, yes, I now want a campaign of nationwide 60-second television commercials, but I'll tell you what I would like, something. You do something to publicise my book. what they are is they're the most useless people in the publishing house, and that's saying something. And they bung them into publicity because it's sort of far a bit further away from what they regard as the meat of the publishing. Oh my God, they seriously didn't know what they were doing. And what you should do. I had this useless publisher. I don't mind name though. Her name was Georgina Moore. Sent me to the wrong the radio station on the wrong day. Sent me down to Gatwick Airport. Took half a day off work to go and sign books. I get all the way there. I have to get a passport. I have to go airside to sign these books in the massive W.A. Smith. They didn't have any. They weren't arriving until the next day. It was all that stuff all the time. With one of my books, the third one. Oh God, I'd gone down with the Delaneys, with Casper and Theo, to do a pub quiz at the Groucho. We're back at the Groucho again. And Barry Delaney had said, would you bring your books? I haven't read it. So I read it. And the woman who ran the Groucho, an American woman called Mary Lou, sees my book on the table and goes, oh, I love that book. Have you read it? And I was able to go, read it? I wrote it. And she goes, oh my God, is there a sequel? And my third book was a sequel to the first one. And I said, there's a sequel. She goes, oh my God, when's it coming out? She goes, look, if you want to have a launch party, we'll give you a room here. As long as it's the Monday night. Monday night's quiet. So she gave me a room at the Groucho. So I invited all the people that I was working with at the time, actors and people I knew, you know, people in EastEnders and Gary and Martin Kemp from Spandau Ballet, just people like, then just phoned up Hello Magazine, my wife did, because she's good at this, said, do you want to see so-and-so and so-and-so, this person and that person, they'll all be at a book launch at the Groucho on Monday night, send a camera down there, camera comes down there, nice little spread in Hello, and it wasn't difficult, you think, that was easy, why can't you do something like that, you know, but they just didn't do anything, and again, you or I would be their worst nightmare, because if you're sort of a very sort of aloof author, they can tell you what to do. Even if you're a villain or a footballer, you're probably, it's not your world, so you'll just do what they tell you. But you and I wouldn't. We'd go, no, I never, and I always tried to hold back, or sometimes I'd try to be helpful, and I'd be so unfailingly polite. Well, perhaps what we should do is, but in the end, I think the advice is just do anything you can. It'll be easier now, because when I did those Facebook and things, so social media hadn't really taken off. Just my advice would be do anything you can personally. And if they do anything at all, great, it's a bonus, but don't expect them to. It's not what they do. You know, so yeah, I certainly advise you to publicise your own book, especially if you work in advertising. You have some idea of what can be done and what should be done. So do that.
And I think we've all seen the general posters for books on the tube, which are just a picture of the book and then some quite shitty line. So that's generally the standard they do. There's no sort of interesting multimedia. You know, I want to talk to my publisher about making it an ebook and things. This is around the time that kind of thing wasn't necessarily that much done, or even a graphic novel. And I don't know, it just, maybe it was too much of an undertaking and too much of an expense for them, but you know, whatever creative ideas.
Their budgets are very, very tight. You can't believe how little they spend. Or they spend on you. Did you ever get the other thing that you'd phone up your publicist usually the publicist, and you get the voicemail that say, because I've heard this from a few authors. Hi, it's Lucy. I'm on tour with an author this week, back in the office on the 14th. You're what bloody author? You never do anything with me. And I've spoken to a couple of authors another copywriter, what he did initially was non-fiction, called Anthony Woodward, who is a very, very good writer. He had all the same issues that we're talking about. And he said he'd phone them up. What fucking author are you you have? They don't seem to do that much of a deal. You'd go out with the sales team sometimes. But no, it was all a bit... It was so terribly amateur that you didn't quite know what to do or say. You didn't want to appear ungracious or upset them, so I never ever did, but my God, they were useless. They really were. But that was all part of it. And that's what I missed, you know. And when I came back to advertising, because you don't make any money, and I was very fortunate that I was freelancing for Abermead Vickers, and they asked me to go back full time, and it was a few years ago when what we used to call the current climate, and I thought, we'll take a full time job, that's lovely, that's excellent. Compared with the actual volume of work required to write a book, write ads just seems so incredibly simple. For a start, you get a brief, they tell you what to say. So it was hard to think, oh my God. Not that I didn't like doing it, I love doing it, but also it's like you've been running marathons and someone asks you to run around the block a couple of times. Reassuringly simple. But what you do miss, what I began to value the other way round, is actually account men and project managers who get things done. And that's what I'm saying about publishers could do with really good account men who keep the wheels rolling, who keep it running. So I had less respect for creatives when I got back, but far more respect for account men.
Yeah, I think that makes sense as well. I think you know we've touched quite a lot on the fact that it doesn't financially really make a lot of sense. I found also the fact that I've been published once actually satisfied a lot of the I'd like to be published vibes going on in my head. I mean, if you've been published once, 90% of the non-financial benefits of being published will have happened to you. So for me, you know, where I wanted to go with the next book, which I ended up writing the sequel to the first one, was, you know, either I was going to make this into some sort of career or it was just still going to be a little hobby on the side and never really make money. And I started to look at what Lee Child was doing, which he would release a book every year without fail in September. And it would be building up a giant sort of library of Lee Child books. I've never read any of them, so I'm not really sure exactly what they're all about. And then people would buy the fifth one and then go back and buy the fourth one, the third one, the first one. And this was absolutely brilliant. So the only thing I really wanted to do was get Lee Child's agent to be my agent. So I sent off my book to the agency, and lo and behold, I did get a very favourable message back saying, I would like to represent you. I really enjoyed your book. Do you want to come along? So we met, and it was really great. And I met Lee Child's agent, and it was all systems go. And then the problem was I had signed 10% of the film rights away to Penguin as part of the Penguin deal. Because I was sitting there thinking, well, either I'd sign them away and I get published by Penguin, or I don't sign them away and I don't get published at all. So I signed them away. And I've since then spoken to several agents who are like, that was probably the stupidest thing you could have done. But my perspective on it is I wouldn't have got published otherwise, or I may not have got published otherwise. And it meant that the characters somewhat belonged to Penguin, which meant that Lee Child's agent wouldn't take it on because they then wouldn't own the rights to the book in entirety. So that was a situation I got myself into. And it's the sort of live and learn experience kind of thing. And I was sitting there thinking, well, that is a shame, but I've got a job that I really enjoy and I'm very happy to just keep on going with it. And I've had a book published and that's cool. And I'll keep writing as a hobby on the side. Which is how I've always treated my writing. But I think to make it in any way, any kind of a ongoing, financially workable career, you have to be a one in a, you know, it's one in a million getting published. I think it's one in a billion to actually manage to make it worth your while in terms of, you know, being able to give up your day job.
And people think you're making a fortune.
Yeah.
People, they weren't unkind, that'd be wrong. They're a little bit pissy. All right for you with your books. I've seen your books in Smith's. You must be rolling in it. You say, oh my God. A, I'm not. And B, you know, pound for pound, you're better off working, stacking shelves in Tesco for, you know, for the money you get, the hours you put in. But again, it sounds pretentious because it is, but it's not about the money. You wouldn't, you know, there's so many things you can do if you're about the money. It is about the satisfaction. It is about the sheer vanity of seeing your book published and the vanity of getting fan mail. If you want that, and many of us do, I certainly do, it's lovely, then, as you say, that will satisfy it. Yeah? And the money, if you get any, is a bonus, but don't think you're going to make any. I mean, I had to go and talk to one of Father Frank was set at as part of a contemporary fiction at North London University. So I go down and do it, and I had a great time and signed all the books. I just absolutely loved it. And then they asked me to go and talk to some creative writing school in Hornsey. So, of course, I go down there and do that. But it was a completely different thing. It was all these people who wanted to get published and wanted to make money out of it. And without sounding like a diva, they didn't know who I was. They didn't care. And I'm sitting in there, and there was one bloke. He was older bloke in his 70s, and someone had obviously said, "My old granddad, you're so clever, you should write a book." So granddad had set the story of creation to verse, Oh my God, Adam and Eve did it. And then there was a little Asian girl who'd written this. That I listened to one after the other, and she'd written her one was especially boring. It was about an arranged marriage, and I remember her going, "It was so boring, so dull. I'm listening to it half asleep," and she's going, and step by step, she walked back to the restaurant, and I woke up and went, "Step by step, how the fuck else is she going to walk back to the restaurant?" And you just—they hadn't thought about what they'd written. They will never be published. They just sit in there in their creative writing school, reading it out to each other. And that's how I said I managed to piss them off by being too cocky and too modest. Because if you want to do it, there is only one way. Sit down and write it. You know, by all means, show it to other people and they might help you with a sounding board. But as you said right at the beginning, it's just down to you and you alone. There's very little collaboration. It's you and your own creativity. But if it is well received, and if you do get praise, and if you do get published, that feeling of that lovely feeling of recognition and validation is like nothing else you'd ever feel. You know, I promise you. So, if you want to do it, it's that Flaubert thing. I'm a writer. Why? Well, I have to be. I can't do it. I can't not. You know, if you feel you have to do it, then you will, and all these things won't bother you. You'll just carry on.
Yeah, I think that's actually quite a good note to coming to the hour to sort of end on. I think, you know, it's probably a lot of things in people's heads before they do it in terms of the work it will take and the chances of success and what will happen if they get published and things like that. I think the reality is far more prosaic than the fantasy, yeah. Probably as it is in many situations if you're an artist or you want to make music or anything like that. So, I think a dose of realism is probably helpful to a lot of people, but at the same time, and on the flip side of that coin, I would say it's one of the most satisfying things I've ever done, and I'm really happy with it and proud of it.
But that thing where people say, whoever said it should be killed, everyone's got a book in them. Everyone's got a leaflet in them. Everyone's got a couple of fucking funny stories, but a book is an awful lot of work, but it is so satisfying. It's such a lovely, lovely thing to do. For your own satisfaction and for the the praise you get for doing so, and if that appeals to you, then you really must.
Absolutely. Well, I think that is a great note to end on. So thanks very much for another hour of your time, Paul. And I'll
stick this up. Sorry, I couldn't Skype it, but I've managed it now.
No problem.
Always lovely to talk to you. The nice thing about talking to you, and I know I'm not alone in this because I spoke to other people that you've done this podcast with, is the way you talk to us makes us say things we didn't realise we felt. And as I'm saying it, I thought, that's quite good. I didn't know I thought that. The others say that too. So keep this going. It's a really brilliant thing. We all enjoy it.
Great. Well, I'm glad it works. And I'll stick this up in a couple of weeks. So
all right.
Okay.
Happy New Year.
You too.
And I'll see you as soon as you come over.
Okay. Cheers, Paul.
All right. Take care. Bye.
The Watch Christmas.